Omaha by Kevin O'Kane. Chapter 1, Monday, January 8, time, 2 p.m. Arms tense and hands clenched nervously onto the steering wheel, Mike rushes to his rented farmhouse several miles north of Des Moines. On a sunless, cold, gray January afternoon, his car rattles and bounces its way west on a nameless gravel county farm road. The outside temperature is minus 7 and the wind chill is minus 20. The car's heater chatters vainly. Mike's beat-up old hardtop heaves and sways over the uneven, loose stone surface, passing endless snow-patched fields. It thumps across an unguarded railroad grade crossing, a loose old ramp of worn wood bridging shiny rails on which endless trains cart corn, soy, coal, and freight to port south. A colorless cluster of silos a few miles north fades dimly in the gathering haze. In the dismal churning sky aloft, flocks of crows scavenge for the last remains of summer. Gusting winds stir dry corn husks into furious small cyclones. Slowing, he turns onto a stony driveway but quickly halts at the sight of what's down the long path ahead. After several moments of panic and indecision, he takes his foot off the brake, and the car creeps slowly forward to the sound of rock crushing beneath its turning tires. He slows to a crunching halt in a small farmyard. In the leaden winter light, engine idling, he looks numbly at the smoldering remains before him. Of the old farmhouse, only the chimney and a few pipes remain upright. The rest is a smoking, fallen ruin of charred timbers, discarded before what was once the entrance are three red gasoline cans. Anxiously looking to see if anyone's hiding in the small grove of trees, he pulls on his heavy gloves and stretches his knit stocking cap low over his ears. The rusty hinge creaks as he opens the door and cautiously gets out. Nervously, he walks up to the blackened remains to see if there is anything salvageable. He hears only the sound of wind and the distant cawing crows. The floors have collapsed into the cellar. Burned pieces of furniture, the stove, refrigerator, and other debris are scattered across the basement. Around the yard and the driveway, the bushes, everywhere, he sees his papers and files blowing about. He realizes that the place was ransacked first, then torched. In frustration, but with a note of despair, he says, "Shit," and kicks at a small rock. It sails upward, then arcs downward into the cellar, landing with a metallic thud on the old stove below. Returning to the car, he leans against its warm hood and surveys the remains. Pulling off one of his gloves, he reaches through his coat into a pocket and extracts a cigarette. Feeling through his pants for his lighter, he slides it out, hunches over, back to the wind, and lights the cigarette. He takes a deep drag and then flicks the tiny ash to the wind. But in the corner of his eye, something moves. He turns quickly. In the distance, to the west, far down the road, a rising, spiraling plume of dust is moving his way. Ambush. They were at the west end of the road. They saw my own trail of dust. They were waiting for me there behind the trees, out of sight of any farms, the way I normally come home. Mike tosses the cigarette, jumps in the car, shoves the transmission into forward, and floors the gas pedal. The rear tires spin on the loose stone, and the car fishtails into a quick 180-degree about-face. It lurches back down the driveway. Swerving onto the county road, he races to escape. Picking up speed, he kicks up his own dust cloud. He wants to get to the blacktop a few miles east in the safety of a small town beyond. The crows screech and scatter skyward from the fields as his car clatters by. A bullet pings his bumper, then several more. Some hit the trunk. He ducks when the rear window bursts in a great starry pattern of cracked glass. They're gaining. His spinning tires on the crushed rock liberate a growing plume of windborne stone dust that hides him from the pursuing SUV. But when the road turns and weaves around small hills, the cloud parts, and both prey and predator get a glimpse at one another clearly. The SUV is now about a quarter mile behind and closing. He struggles to open the gap, but he's going as fast as he can on this bumpy road without losing control. Their SUV is better suited for this terrain. From behind, they shoot blindly into his spiraling screen of rock powder. Few find their target, but the sound of each round grows closer. Ahead, hidden by a small hill, the grade crossing comes into view. However, to his left, a southbound freight rumbles his way at 80 miles an hour. Both he and 100 cars of freight, preceded by 3 soot-belching diesel locomotives, are seconds from the crossing. Panic, Mike whispers to himself, "This is it." The silence of the winter wasteland shatters as all 3 engines' air horns shriek in a thunderous, dissonant warning chorus. Seeing the inevitable collision, the engineers quickly shunt the air brakes and flip the emergency overrides to the electric traction motors. 800 axles scream metal against metal, while the giant diesels rev to full power. The electric motors rumble menacingly into reverse. Knowing that it will take the better part of a mile to bring this juggernaut to a halt, the frightened engineers brace for the unavoidable impact. Mike flattens the accelerator pedal to the floor. The old V8 throbs to redline, the transmission slams out of overdrive, into high, wheels spin, and his car lurches unsteadily forward. His crushed stone dust plume belches. Mike's car rumbles up onto an airborne over the wood planks, just as the first screeching, trumpeting locomotive slices through the crossing. His car slams back to earth. It jolts up and down and heaves left to right. Mike hits the brakes, fighting to regain control. Finally, it steadies. He made it. His pursuers had gained to within 50 yards, but as a result became fully engulfed by the dust cloud. Greedily focused only on closure with Mike's car, they scarcely hear nor heed the warning horns. Suddenly, the dust, cut from its source, becomes transparent. They see the rushing leading edge of the second engine and its vivid, speed-blurred red and yellow logo. The driver screams and slams on the brake. The SUV tumbles out of control and begins to roll. The four yelling guys inside are thrown around like sacks. The SUV careens into the second engine, just ahead of the diesel's rear carriage. It is swiftly sucked beneath, sliced and shredded. The derailing engine disconnects from the one ahead. The third engine quickly jumps the tracks, along with the first of many cars of heavily loaded rolling stock. The second and third engines flip on their sides and skid sideways across the tracks. Thousands of gallons of diesel fuel spill. The freight cars tumble and zigzag off the tracks, dumping tons of dried corn in great heaps onto the mangled remains of the engine and the SUV. The gasoline from the SUV's ruptured gas tank ignites. The diesel-soaked corn ripples into a tide of flame. Black smoke and flames billow skyward as one car after another continues to pile corn, coal, chemicals, and fuel upon the pyre of flaming railroad wreckage. About a mile beyond, Mike slows to a stop, gets out, and looks behind him. His hands tremble and his heart races as he lights a cigarette and stares at the growing, wind-driven inferno building in the distance. Slowly, he regains his composure, tosses the cigarette, and resumes his journey east. Fire engines and police cars race past him on their way to the wreck. A few miles later, he joins the paved road. From there, he turns onto an intersecting highway south, then east again, and finally up onto the I-35 south on-ramp. Soon, it merges with I-80 west for the beltway circuit around Des Moines. Tapping out a cigarette with one hand, he puts it in his mouth, punches the lighter, and flips on the radio. Next stop, Omaha. Mike's bullet-pocked car thumps west on the segmented concrete road slabs, past scattered truck stops, farms, silos, grim towns, endless fence posts, and the barren winter fields upon which prowl great flocks of black birds. The sky is dark ahead. Fast-moving clouds churn above, and the wind continues to build from the southeast. The radio station in Des Moines says there'll be 2 feet of snow by morning, and gale winds, along with severe blowing and drifting. Temperatures will drop well below zero. A monster blizzard is building in the Rockies and will soon prey upon the plains. Buffeted by the growing crosswinds, his car veers unpredictably from one side of the lane to the other. He passes long processions of 40-ton 18-wheelers and triple-bottom trailer rigs, weaving like flags in the growing storm. The gusts are now over 40 miles an hour. Just west of Adair, Mike figures it's about another 60 miles to go. The snow will start soon. If he's lucky, he'll just make Omaha before the roads close. As he motors slowly through Council Bluffs in the gray and wasting light of dying day, snow begins to accumulate on the road. Giant IA-DOT sand trucks with 10-foot plow blades are out in conga lines making a freak show of yellow strobe lights flaring in the horizontal blur of wind-driven flakes. His car jerks as it tracks its way west through the icy ruts out of Iowa and into Nebraska. Crossing the deserted Missouri I-480 bridge into Omaha, high above the frigid river below, he struggles to keep the car in lane now that he is fully exposed to the unobstructed fury of the gale. Finally, making it across the bridge onto the elevated interstate, he drives through central Omaha. Scarce window lights in the tall buildings confess that their occupants have fled for the day. A few miles west and south of downtown, he exits the interstate down onto a deserted street in a semi-industrial neighborhood. A few blocks from the off-ramp, he pulls into the nearly empty parking lot of a faded motel. After checking in, he dashes across the road to a convenience store. Returning a few minutes later, he shakes the snow from his coat and settles in for a stale, plastic-wrapped sandwich, fries, and a plastic cup of cheap wine drawn from a screw-top bottle of limited vintage. Retrieving a carton of cigarettes from his gym bag, he extracts a pack. After slapping the top several times on his palm to compress the loose tobacco, he opens it and taps out the sprout of a new cigarette. Lighting it, he inhales deeply, leans back, and chugs another gulp of the wine. Surrounded by the litter of his bad convenience store supper, he broods over his predicament. He sits still in the dimly lit small room. The only sounds are those of the whistling wind and some metal sign in the parking lot flapping and squeaking in the gusts. Staring at the stippled ceiling above, he wonders what's next. If his former friend in St. Louis finds him, not much. A few cigarettes and the better part of the wine bottle later, he clicks on the TV and flips between a motley collection of local stations before settling on one. He stares numbly at aging, career career-end readers bantering cheerfully about the weather between seed and feed commercials. The storm sprawls anonymously across 1,000 miles of town, city, farms, cattle, prairie, and people. Final totals will be measured in feet, followed by massive drifting, and then an arctic blast of frigid air. Temperatures will fall to minus 25 with wind chills to minus 60. These are forecast to settle in for the next week or more. Mike winces as he turns to eat the last of the soggy, cold, greasy French fries from the oily paper packet. As a TV commercial drones on, he decides that, despite the entreaties and many fine examples shown for his edification, in the final analysis, no, he doesn't want any hybrid seed corn this year. A quick flip to the local weather feed shows the radar with white in all directions. For now, at least, maybe he's safe, hidden by the storm. Time, 8 p.m. He checks his watch. It's 8. Clicking off the TV, he moans and thinks to himself that the time has come to get on with it. He pulls out the street map of Omaha, which he bought at a gas station over in Iowa, and checks the location of the motel against the address written on a stained small piece of paper he carried in his wallet. The place he's looking for should be about 2 blocks away, more or less. Looking out the window, he decides that there is no way he can take the car, not in this storm. It'll be buried in a drift. He figures he's got to walk it. It's not really that far, but in this weather, it won't be nice. Reluctantly, he begins the ritual of winter robing, pulling on his jacket, scarf, stocking cap, hood, and gloves. Finally, draped like a mummy, he steps stiffly out into the parking lot, where his face is quickly slapped by a 40-mile-an-hour sub-zero horizontal gale of snow. The flakes hit him like blown sand. Staggering, he stretches the scarf further over his face, leaving just a slit for his eyes between the scarf and the pulled-down stocking cap. Thus, girded and driven by relentless fate, he starts hiking the two torturous blocks up the street. Trudging up the middle of the deserted, snow-swept road, he bends into the gale like some anonymous lumbering animal on the prairie. The wind and snow lash down on him in turbulent waves. Bathed in the orange light of sodium vapor street lamps, his eyes see only barely a blur through the tightly wrapped scarf. After a block and a half, he finally looks up into the wind. There it is, he thinks to himself. Through the dense and blowing snow and a swaying nearby street lamp, he sees a huge, hulking brick building half a block away. A great green neon sign blinks brightly through the near whiteout blizzard blur. Maroon. What the hell does that mean? Infrared sensors and imaging devices automatically begin to track his movement. Approaching closer, he sees that, whatever it means, it's big. Holy shit, he mutters under his breath. Look at the size of it. What the hell is this, a warehouse? He crunches onward through the ruts of snow, his goal now only a few dozen yards ahead. Nearing the building, he looks through a small fogged window near the doors and sees the place is mobbed. To himself, he wonders, how many people in Omaha go clubbing in a blizzard? Why are they out on a night like this? Now, at the entrance, he pauses and gapes. Before him are massive doors, each maybe 15 feet high and 10 feet wide. Old warehouse doors made of heavy cedar beams and hinged on massive brass fittings. Curious, he kicks off the top layer of snow and discovers that the wide steps are marble with inlaid brass, the logo of the original owner, he supposes. On brazen steps, the marble threshold rose, and brazen plates the cedar beams enclose, he recites, the flickering memory of some long-forgotten English lit class. Cut and hinged into one of the ancient doors is a portal of more normal size. He pulls on it hard against the battering wind and stumbles in.